The police is interesting, right? Because it's one of the very, very few institutions in which discretionary power is greater the lower down the organization it is.
Welcome to Ideas. I'm Nahla Ayed. And this is the British author and academic Mark Neoclaus.
Okay, so the simple Bobby on the beat has an amazing discretionary power that is way, way beyond the discretionary power of, let's use a similar example if you like, a soldier, right? Where the soldier is literally following orders given to them there and then. Whereas the police officer is given carte blanche powers on the street in everyday encounters. It's a remarkable institution in that sense.
And those everyday encounters often involve members of marginalized communities, from patrols to street checks to worse. In 2020, nearly half of the people shot by police in Canada were identified as Indigenous and close to 20% Black, according to a Canadian press investigation. 9 of the approximately 34 fatal shootings started as wellness checks on mentally ill people. Historian Steve Hewitt.
And the police, despite often the way they're portrayed, are not a neutral organization. The police are there to enforce and ensure dominant versions of order. And that order is as defined by those who have power and often in opposition to those who don't have power.
American sociologist Alex Vitelli.
Yeah, if we look at what police actually do day in and day out, if we look at the 10 million arrests that police perform every year, they're almost entirely located in the poorest and most vulnerable communities in our society. And the purpose of the vast majority of those arrests is not to produce public safety as much as it is to manage a set of social problems that threaten the existing economic and political arrangements.
This is the first of a two-part series on the role of police in our society. It's by Ideas contributor Kyle G. Brown. This episode explores the birth of policing in Western society, to its iteration today as a powerful overseer whose authority is increasingly questioned. We're calling this program The Evolution of Policing.
My name is Peter Sanziak. I spent 29 years as a member of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. My father was an RCMP member. It was the only job I ever wanted to do.
Peter Sanziak retired in 2019 after having worked in everything from drug enforcement to national security. For his first 8 years, he was a regular RCMP officer in Western Canada, policing First Nations communities.
So I was a white man in an Indigenous community, and, you know, like that is what it is, right? But I always found Indigenous communities very welcoming. You know, we played hockey with people. We played ball in the summer. The teams were mixed. The people were mixed. We went to social gatherings to some extent in the communities, and we tried to be part of those communities. Now, obviously, we stayed away from a lot of the nighttime activities because the communities had issues with drinking and stuff. But we had lots of, I would say, friends in the community.
One day in Sik Sika First Nation, just outside of Calgary, Sanziak learned something about policing that has remained with him ever since.
When I was a very young constable, I went by the bar one day, and there was an old man sitting on the steps. So under the Indian Act, you can't serve liquor on the reserve. So the town just off the edge of the reserve had a bar. And there's an old man sitting on the step, and he had a walker. And it was a nice day, but I remember stopping and I asked what he was doing. And he said, well, he was waiting for a ride home, and he lived in an area maybe 10 minutes from town. So I said, well, I'm not too busy. I'll give you a ride home. So I folded his walker up and put it in the car and helped him into the car. And I never had any dealings with this guy. Just, it was something I could do. So I put him in the back of the car, and I was putting him in the car. A couple of young guys came out and said, where are you taking? I think his name was Alan. Where are you taking Alan? And I said, well, I said, he needs a ride home and I'm not too busy. So I said, I can take him home. Anyway, I did. I took him home and never thought anything of it. And a couple weeks later, I got in a fight in the bar trying to arrest someone. I was by myself. And as I was dealing with the guy, a couple guys tried to intervene. And I heard the voice of a young woman who grabbed and said, "That's the guy that took Alan home. Leave him alone." And I didn't know when I took the old man home that it was going to have that leave that kind of an effect, but it did. And it was just the fact that I had done something nice for someone in the community, and that had been noticed by people in the community.
The scene that Sancik describes, police in close contact with the community, using minimal force when necessary, and building relationships, is a world away from the recent high-profile instances of officer violence that have prompted calls for defunding or outright abolition of the police. The question is, how did we get to this point? A clue can be found in the origins of policing. 17th century Paris was dangerous after dark. Robberies were common, prompting King Louis XIV to create the Paris Police in 1667, the first such force in Europe. It was headed by Nicolas de la Reynie, a former magistrate. His powers and responsibilities were extensive. He brought about new rules for street traffic, the sale of meat and wine. Residents had to clean outside of their homes, and he had more than 6,000 lamps installed, earning Paris the moniker City of Lights. La Reynie also set out to dismantle the slums, home to a swelling population of the poor who were flocking to the city.
When the French speak of police in the 17th century, it is a very broad meaning, which has to do with regulating urban life.
Jacques de Maillard is director of the Centre for Sociological Research on Law and Penal Institutions, located just outside of Paris.
So it's not only about crime, it's more globally about the regulation of urban life.
New systems of surveillance allowed for regulation on a whole new scale. The police created a vast intelligence network consisting of inspectors, secret agents, informants, and prostitutes.
The police of the king is using informants to control the population, to control political opinions. So this notion of a state police has been very strong at the beginning.
And their role included monitoring political opponents and quelling dissent, which was still being handled by militias and armed forces in much of Europe. I'm on a train from Paris to London.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few minutes we'll be arriving at London Saint-Pancras International. Last stop time is 11:27 local time.
During the medieval period in England, commoners were mostly under the control of landowners. Villages and towns were responsible for their own law enforcement. Able-bodied men volunteered or were called upon to conduct night patrols. With the end of feudalism, peasants were freed or expelled from the lands to which they had been bound. High population growth, rising prices, and a lack of work forced many to travel in search of employment. By the 15th and 16th centuries, large numbers of men on the move were making some people nervous.
And the problem for the authorities was that this freedom was a freedom from their masters, a freedom from their lords. And so this freedom to the authorities, to the ruling class at the time, looked to them like masterlessness. You know, so they were talking about masterless men wandering around.
Mark Neoklaus is a professor of political economy at Brunel University in London, England.
And these masterless creatures were assumed to be committing crime, were assumed to be a political threat, but more than anything, there was a danger that they weren't actually engaged in labour for a living, that they were finding some form of subsistence which wasn't work.
Such as hunting and gathering firewood. But the merchant class needed workers for their rapidly expanding industries.
And the question was, how do we get people engaged in labouring for a wage, for a new kind of master? That master would eventually be called capital, because that's what it was. Now, how do we do that?
Socioeconomic shifts were already underway that might solve this problem. For example, large areas were being carved up as private property, reducing commoners' ability to access and live off the land. By the 1800s, gentry land ownership doubled to 50% of all arable land. And over at the ports, there was the custom of taking home spilled or spoiled goods. Patrick Cahoon, a Scottish-born businessman and magistrate, wanted to solve this problem.
Now, Colquhoun completely overcalculates how much goods the workers are taking. And then he also says, well, and the other thing is, what happens is as soon as you allow them to take it, they're going to encourage more spillages, right? So you accidentally cut into a bag of sugar, accidentally in inverted commas here. So a worker accidentally cuts into a bag of sugar, the sugar spills, and the workers take it home. In other words, the custom of the perquisite, or the custom of taking that commodity as a perk, is in enabling the workers to take goods home for free and to therefore work less for a wage. Okay, so what does he do? He says we have to cut this custom out. We have to turn this custom into a crime. And if we turn this custom into a crime, then the workers will be forced to more and more work for a wage rather than just partially for a wage and partially for the extra goods they can take home and share between them. So what this does in terms of dock work is it imposes the wage form on the workers. Right? They're not allowed any longer to take home the various perquisites and share them and exchange them, sell them and so forth. They're now forced to work solely for the wage.
There was also the problem of widespread theft of port goods. So to deal with these issues, the River Thames Police was created, the first police force in London. It was headed by Cahoon and privately funded by the West India Merchants and the West India Planters Committees.
And at this point, the police became actively involved in what I call the fabrication of social order, and in particular, a fabrication of a new industrialised capitalist order. So this is a massive... So, you know, we need to think about Colquhoun not only as, you know, introducing a police for the River Thames to secure the ships and to secure the commodities. We need to recognise that what Colquhoun was doing was a major event in the imposition of the wage form on dock workers.
With the ending of centuries-old means of subsistence living, commoners were forced into full-time wage labour, or wage form, as Neil Klaus calls it.
And similar things, similar practices, similar shifts are taking place in the late 18th, early 19th century across a whole range of other industries. All the fabric industries, the wool industry, the cotton industry. And so what happens is that the wage form is imposed on the working class universally. In effect, what these new police measures do is they make the working class. So my argument is that the modern policing is centrally about the making of the working class.
The Industrial Revolution was creating unprecedented levels of wealth, for some. But for the throngs of commoners moving from the countryside to the cities, many were mired in poverty and squalor. Jacques de Maillard.
There was a transformation of European societies towards more unequal societies. And this transformation leads to growing disorders, to rising crime in urban settings. And the urbanization of European and Western societies in the 19th century is absolutely crucial to explain the emergence of police organizations. Because in urban settings, you have many anonymous individuals living together. And so the traditional communitarian regulation in a society where everybody knows each other doesn't work anymore. That these new working classes coming to cities to work in the industrialist economy are linked to new threats in Western societies.
Ensuring social order fell more and more to the police. They dealt not only with crimes in the strict sense of the term, but also violations of social mores, like public drunkenness, noise, loitering, sex work, vices that had long been checked by the church and religious societies. The late French philosopher Michel Foucault.
En fait, la police a été depuis le 18e siècle.
Since the 18th century, the police have been a formidable authority, charged with social regulation, surveillance, and with the incessant correction of behavior. It's a regulatory body concerned not so much with justice as with normalization. It wasn't so much about enforcing the law, but about normalizing people's behavior.
The police were also looking for any signs of dissent and upheaval, which were frequent in 18th and 19th century Europe, a time when citizens were protesting for greater economic and political change.
The traditional way of the state to respond to protests, to demonstrations, to riots, was to deploy the militia.
Historian Steve Hewitt. Originally from Canada, he specializes in policing, security, and intelligence at the University of Birmingham in England.
And the militia are, of course, militarily trained, heavily armed, and are used to fighting other soldiers, and their response often is to use deadly force. And you can see how unpalatable that would become in a supposedly democratic society, but also how it would then lead to even more opposition in terms of protests and challenges to authority.
But they were often put down with merciless ferocity.
Good people get here. Since times are so hard.
British director Mike Leigh's film Peter Lou tells the story of an infamous bloodbath.
My song to the poor, it doth pay some regard for trade being dead and weaving out of war.
On a bright August day in 1819, 60,000 civilians, many dressed in their Sunday best, including a large number of women and children, peacefully gathered at St. Peter's Field in Manchester, England. They were demanding democratic reforms, including the right to political representation.
We are on the brink of liberty.
At the time, only about 3% of the population, wealthy landowners, could vote. And poverty and hunger were rife through the general population.
We demand that our suffering cease.
Now is the time for
the protest turned bloody when a cavalry arrived and charged the crowd. More than 650 people were badly wounded and up to 18 were killed, civilians beaten by clubs, stabbed by sabers, and trampled to death. Massive outrage eventually led to parliamentary reforms and amplified calls for a more peaceful alternative to militias. In the ensuing decades, in more European cities, police took over the job of ensuring public order. Jacques de Maillard.
First, you have a demilitarization of public order. More and more, you use police agents which do not consider demonstrators, participants in mobilizations, in protest as enemies, but as citizens who are in anger.
By the 19th century, two distinct shifts are underway, which will become increasingly at odds with one another. On the one hand, governments take human rights more seriously, such as the right to peaceful protest. On the other, modern states are increasingly reliant on surveillance to monitor dissent.
Policing solves a whole set of political problems.
Alex Vitali is professor of sociology at Brooklyn College in New York and the author of The End of Policing.
And one of the things policing does is it tries to manage the uprisings in a more efficient manner where fewer people get killed, and attempting to do so within a legal framework that provides some political cover for the people who benefit from these arrangements, and therefore giving these regimes more legitimacy.
Historian Steve Hewitt and I have come to Parliament Square in the centre of London, with statues of some of history's most influential leaders looming over us. Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Winston Churchill, and another British Prime Minister, Robert Peel, who earlier in his career founded the Metropolitan Police Service in 1829, hence the term bobbies. A tribute to the man known as the father of modern British policing.
Robert Peel didn't invent policing, but he brought, in the British context, a much more professional approach to it, a more organized approach to this sort of chaotic system in Great Britain, and, you know, ensured about uniforms and about rules, that all of that begins, the British version begins with Peel in the 1820s, especially in cities like London that was growing rapidly as the 19th century went on.
A year after forming, the Met had grown from 1,000 to more than 3,000 officers. Decked out in top hats and dark blue tailcoats, the constables were expected to abide by Peel's 9 principles of policing, invoked, if not always honored, by forces to this day, including in Canada and the US. The first is, quote, to prevent crime and disorder as an alternative to their repression by military force. Robert Peel was also largely responsible for what would become the Royal Irish Constabulary, a kind of colonial paramilitary force.
The Royal Irish Constabulary is a force designed in its original form to help control Catholics in Ireland so that Ireland would remain under British control. And when Sir John A. Macdonald, Canada's first Prime Minister, is looking for a policing model, Canada's just acquired this great Western territory, the model he looks to is the RIC, the Royal Irish Constabulary. He's after a colonial police force that can be used to control Indigenous peoples already living in this territory so they can be moved aside to allow European settlers to flood into the West, which leads to the creation of the Northwest Mounted Police in 1873. It's deployed westward in 1874, and its job is to help facilitate the movement of Indigenous peoples off of their traditional lands into the lands assigned through the treaty system onto reserves.
Keeping them away from European communities and curtailing their use of traditional hunting grounds. Despite initial opposition from some officers with the Northwest Mounted Police, the RCMP's predecessor, they eventually became instrumental in enforcing it.
And there is evidence that emerged, I think, in the 1980s, and it's been reiterated, reinforced in the book Clearing the Plains by James Daschuk, that where Indigenous peoples were reluctant to move on to the reserve, the Mounties were involved in helping withhold food rations as a way of putting pressure and forcing Indigenous peoples to move on to the reserves.
Conditions on the reserves were dire. Thousands died from hunger and disease. A traditional food source, the buffalo, was close to extinction. Some First Nations people attempted to steal settlers' cattle to survive, but were thwarted by police. Just as urban policing was a response to industrialization and population growth, new forms of policing rose out of colonial settlement. Sociologist Alex Vitale.
The Texas Rangers and the RCMP in Canada, these are early colonial police forces. Their primary objective is not like enforcing criminal law among settlers. It's about driving out Indigenous populations, putting down any resistance from those populations, and facilitating the expansion of white settlement. So these colonial police forces, as they become more established and institutionalized, there is often less of a need for overt violence because the groups resisting them have been driven out. So then they start to look more and more like any other police department that is managing the settled community to make sure that order is maintained within that community, and therefore there isn't the same need for that kind of high level of violence that Indigenous populations were often subjected to.
And violence by the Mounties against the First Nations population would come in many forms, including on government orders, forcibly removing Indigenous children from their families and sending them away to residential schools.
Policing exists in relationship to regimes of exploitation. Most police forces in the world were created in the 19th century to support slavery, colonialism.
And so with respect to, you know, either black or indigenous populations, these were, you know, colonized and subjugated populations.
Akwasi Owusu-Bempah is a criminologist and assistant professor at the University of Toronto.
We had, following the abolition of slavery, of course, a segregation that was practiced both legal and de facto in this country. And so, of course, the police would have played a role in policing the social order and policing the racial order of the time. And so, you know, when we look at the American experience, and we can see very clearly, of course, in the American South, policing having emerged out of the slave patrols, you know, we have a different experience here in Canada, of course, but I don't think we can deny the fact that the police then, as they do to an extent now, police racial boundaries within our societies.
You're listening to The Evolution of Policing, the first of a two-part series on the role of police in our society. This is Ideas. We're heard on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius XM, in Australia on ABC Radio National, and around the world at cbc.ca/ideas. You can also find us on the CBC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Nala Ayed. Ideas contributor Kyle G. Brown's documentary is called The Evolution of Policing. Here again is retired RCMP officer Peter Sanczak, who began his career in 1990 policing Indigenous communities in Western Canada.
Coming from a very stable family environment, I had never seen that level of dysfunction, and it speaks to, I mean, we all know, it speaks to the system of residential schools, it speaks to the Indian Act, it speaks to a lot of things that were over and above anything that I had any control over. I just was there to pick up the pieces.
The policing systems of many Western countries have been shaped in part by their colonial legacies. American sociologist Alex Vitale.
So the first state police force in the United States, the Pennsylvania State Police Force, is actually modeled on the U.S. occupation forces in the Philippines. So there's always been a dialogue between the American military and its foreign adventures and domestic policing.
France also possessed dozens of colonies around the world well into the 20th century, particularly in North Africa, where so-called pacification techniques would be honed and applied back home. Mathieu Rigouste is a sociologist specializing in policing, security, and their colonial roots.
Throughout the 19th century, colonial troops are repatriated and generals return to France to shape and influence the transformation of police and law enforcement, and they drew on a range of methods used in France's colonial wars of domination.
From crowd control to identity checks to surveillance. Methods, say Rigouste, used against workers' organizations. And later on the growing immigrant population from France's former colonies. We're in Château Rouge near Paris's Montmartre district. It sits just below the famous Sacré-Cœur Basilica, a working-class district with many of the residents from sub-Saharan and North Africa. There is often a heavy police presence.
Today, we have a police force that is occupying the territory in a way. Every day, police are here in vehicles, in uniform, to frighten and terrorize undocumented people, to make them feel insecure, to prevent people from going freely about their business, from simply being in the street. It's an occupation force which conducts manhunts, identity checks, and provocations very regularly.
A phone camera captures a policeman pointing a weapon at a group of teens who have gathered to watch a boy being wrestled to the ground by another officer. It's one of several such videos showing controversial police interactions with immigrant communities, which have mobilized resistance against police abuses.
Moi, je m'appelle Jean Kakevin, j'ai 28 ans, et je suis originaire du quartier du Paris 12e, là où j'ai grandi depuis tout petit. Mon père, moi, il est malien. Maintenant, il est en France, il a son titre de séjour.
My name is Kevin Dianca. I am 28 years old, and I'm from the Paris 12th district. I grew up here since I was little. My father is Malian.
Il est né en Afrique.
And my mother is French. I was first stopped by police at 9 years old.
It was 9 in the evening. Kevin and his friends were hanging out near their homes in a working class area in the 12th arrondissement, as they often did, talking, laughing, and then a neighbor called the police to complain.
About 15 cops arrived, they're everywhere. They seal off the exits. The only way we could get away was to jump in the park over there.
From where we stood, on a hill outside his apartment complex, it was a steep 10-foot jump, over a railing, to get to the park below.
Some of us run, some of us won't run. We are not all the same. But as soon as the police come, it escalates. And sometimes the police just appear out of nowhere. "Hey, get over to the side," they'll say. "I'm going to frisk you." "No, why?" I say. "I didn't do anything. There are no grounds for it." "Get over to the side." I don't give in. They start hitting me. I defend myself. Then I'm arrested and detained for resisting arrest and insulting a police officer for nothing. They hit us with batons, tear gas. They frisk us around our private parts. Insults. All kinds of insults. That we are not in our home country, even though we were born here.
France has a widespread and long-standing policing problem.
Canadian Lana Hollow is a senior legal officer with the Open Society Justice Initiative in Paris. She says police abuses against young men from ethnic minorities have multiplied in recent years.
And I'd say the entry point is often the routine discriminatory identity checks, which are accompanied systematically by frisks, so pat-downs, often searches. And so in practice, what this means is the police put young Black or Arab men, young, in other words, it often starts around even 12 or 14. So they will approach them for an identity check when they're doing routine activities in public space and often ask them to stand against the wall, so spread-eagled, and then also proceed to body pat-downs and searches. And unfortunately, this seems to more and more frequently be accompanied also by touching genital areas, buttocks. And then it's often accompanied by other forms of physical abuse, racist language, sometimes by what we'll call arbitrary detention, which is where the police will just take individuals to the police station without a reason, hold them there for a while, release them. And occasionally, well, not so occasionally, the cases are getting more and more frequent. The situation degrades. And it can result in death. So you have cases of individuals who end up killed where the entry point was sort of what they would call a routine identity check.
Hollow's organization is part of a class action suit against the French state, accusing the police of repeated and widespread racial profiling. The UN and the EU have also denounced French police for using excessive force, particularly against young people.
I mean, when one talks about identity check, stop and search, often people think we're thinking of public safety. But in practice, the way these are used is very much a form of social control and even humiliation of the victims. The way the check takes place, there is almost often a desire to humiliate to the greatest extent possible the person checked. And often these searches that you can call deep searches where they touch the genitalia, where there's, where they spend time lingering in the buttocks area. And you often in the accounts, the individuals will talk about how this is also accompanied by sort of almost treating them as homosexual. And there's often this other language that also exists. And I think this is difficult for me to translate into English, actually. I feel a bit uncomfortable even repeating the comments. Petite tapette, attention, tu vas voir ce que tu vas voir, t'aimes ça, non?
Ah, you little homophobic slur. Wait and see what's coming to you. You like that, don't you?
Yes, that sort of thing. Exactly. And in front of the friends. So, you know, this is about males checking males. And so, you know, also using, I mean, there's obviously homophobia that gets involved as well. So humiliating the other males in front of their male friends and, you know, showing their ultimate power over them.
Kevin Dianka, now 28 years of age, says repetitive harassment by police that he, his friends, and so many others have experienced is soul-destroying.
Alors imaginez le sale noir, le singe, et tout ce qu'il en suit, sale arabe, sale chinois.
So imagine being called a dirty black, a monkey, and all that follows, dirty Arab, dirty Chinese. It hurts. Because we are no dirtier than a white person, than a Frenchman. I've heard all of the insults. All of them. And when they call you a dirty monkey and that gets on your nerves and you respond, where do you end up? In police custody. That's all. Or if you manage to run away, the manhunt begins. For hours. The police do not give up.
Dianka is one of 17 young people from immigrant backgrounds who brought legal action against the police. Most of them were between the ages of 11 and 18 when the alleged assaults occurred. In October 2020, a civil court ruled that the incidents of police brutality and irregular arrests of minors were proof of gross negligence on the part of the French state. And the case also brought to light a database of little-known police policies and practices.
And in that database is a category, undesirables, essentially disturbers, perturbateurs in French, indésirables perturbateurs. And in that category, they can fill in these checks to evacuate public space. And in the oral testimony of the police who were actually interrogated during the hearing, which is also very rare in France, that police would actually be interrogated about these sort of daily practices of discriminatory harassment. They indicated that, you know, this was orders and that it was common to talk about undesirables, which I think says a lot about the function that identity checks, stops and searches play in society. And it does go to France's colonial history, and it is a form of social control. It's essentially sending a signal to these parts of the population to stay in their place, that they should know their place. This is their place. They're treated as potentially suspect, potentially problematic, potentially criminal. And this is a sort of teaching people to stay where they should in society. And it's interiorized in that way.
But there's a growing pushback, and not just in France. In 2013, a federal judge found the New York City Police Department liable for a pattern of racial profiling and unconstitutional stops in primarily poor communities. Yet activists say targeted police harassment continues, compounded now by the use of invasive digital searches. Skepticism of police claims of reform is not restricted to New York. In Ontario, after more restrictive rules on street checks were introduced in 2017, police data claim rates fell precipitously.
Whereas the police were, you know, conducting tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of these checks across the province in a given year, most jurisdictions, these have gone down to just a handful.
University of Toronto criminologist Akwasi Owusu-Bempa says these figures are deceiving.
Now, I think it's important to note that just because these regulated interactions have decreased and the information being entered into police databases has decreased, that does not mean that the police are not still stopping and searching individuals. They still have the powers, of course, to do that, and they are still doing that on a regular basis. We conducted a study in the Greater Toronto Area over the last couple of years in which we asked members of the general public to tell us about whether or not they'd been stopped by the police. And we broke this data down by gender as well and by race. So we've got information on Black, white, and Asian people living in the Greater Toronto Area. In the 2 years prior to these surveys, 40% of the black respondents said that they'd been stopped by the police. And in fact, just over a quarter of the black respondents said they'd been stopped on two or more occasions by the police. And this was, you know, compared with just about 10% of white and Asian people. So this idea that the police are no longer stopping and questioning members of the public because we have the new street check regulations in effect, to me is completely inaccurate. It's not borne out by self-report surveys and self-report data. What we've seen with the introduction of these regulations is simply a reduction in the documentation of these interactions. So the police are clearly still stopping people. They're still questioning people, but they're not necessarily collecting the information about those individuals and entering them into the databases. So really what we've lost here is actually the paper trail to tell us what the police have been doing with respect to their stop and search practices.
Former Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders has said he does not support random police stops. But when checks are done right, he said they enhance public safety. However, the vast majority of people stopped are not engaged in any criminal activity. In 2010 in the UK, for example, the arrest rate from stop and searches for drugs was only 7%.
It's not an uncommon thing for me to be stopped or harassed by the police, no matter where I am, no matter how I'm dressed.
Queen Kokoye, who is in her 30s, is a Toronto-based artist and activist born in Barbados.
It's a fear and reality that I've come to live with. And it's like almost like, oh, you see them, you're like, oh God, I hope they're not bored today.
Kokoye remembers a particularly humiliating police encounter when she was 17.
I was coming out of a convenience store. Somebody stopped to ask for some change in Scarborough. And I was very much like dismissive of the person, got in the vehicle, we drove off, and a bunch of cop cars pull up. And they're like, oh, like, you know, get out the car. We're going to search the car. And me and the person with me didn't really like know our rights. Not that, I mean, it would have mattered if we knew. I think their intention was to search the car, and that's just what they were going to do, regardless if we gave them permission or not. They searched the car. You know, I'm standing outside of the car. I'm the passenger in the vehicle. They're like, oh, like, we're getting a female officer to come search you. We know you have drugs. Like, just tell us where it is. And I'm just like, what? Like, what are you? I'm like, what? Like, what are you even talking about? Like, I don't have drugs. We just came from the convenience store. We're going home, you know? And a female police officer gets there. I had like a fake bun in my hair. She takes the bun out of my hair. She's searching the bun. She was like, I know you got it somewhere. Like, just tell me where it is. I'm like, I don't have nothing. Like, I don't have anything. And I remember like a bus, a TTC bus was driving by, and she lifts up my shirt and exposed my breasts to the bus as she searches me. And I remember feeling like mortified, you know.
Just one of many times she has been stopped randomly by police.
We live in a condo downtown by the waterfront, so it's a very white area. In the back of the building, there's a boardwalk where our neighbors hang out, but also like folks from all across the city. It's a nice area, a very wealthy area. Like, the condos are multi-million dollar condos right by the water, right?
Recently, she was outside of her home watching her daughter take photos of another artist. The shoot was going well. Then, two male police officers rode up on bikes.
And they come over to us. Now, there's all kinds of people outside. There's another group doing a photo shoot. There's people like outside openly drinking, like with wine bottles and all. Turn back around, the officers are coming across the street. And in my head, I'm like, oh God, I knew it, you know? I just told my daughter to keep taking the pictures because we're not doing anything wrong. Like, we live here. This is our neighborhood. We were othered, as usual. Officers asking us all these questions. And the joke is, like, typically I wouldn't feel to answer any of their questions, especially when it feels like an interrogation with a smile, you know. But I just started thinking about everything that had happened recently to our community, all the violence, and I'm like, what, like, how do I keep safe in this moment? Like, how do I keep my daughter safe in this moment? And the only thing I could think of was, I don't know, answer their questions. But I'm like burning, like, on the inside while I'm answering these questions, because I'm like, you know, why are we being asked these things, you know? And typically, like, I wouldn't even have responded like that. But all I could think about is my daughter witnessing harm come to me and what that would do to her.
It's the worst type of feeling ever. It's extreme fear. There are times where you feel like you're going to pee yourself because you're so scared, because you're thinking to yourself, what's going to be the outcome of this?
John Jack says he's been stopped as many as four times in a single month by police in the Greater Toronto Area. In light of this, it may not be surprising to hear, Jack is Black.
Am I going to be just let go? I could just go and live my life? Or is this going to be something where I'm going to have to get down on the ground, I'm going to get handcuffed, or I'm going to have to go through that whole procedure of saying that I didn't do anything? Just so many things goes through your mind during that interaction. And you pray, you want to cry, you want to scream. It's a collage of things. I just want to go home. I just want to go home. I could always remember myself repeating that in my head. I just want to go home.
Jack is a frontline community worker. He now also teaches courses in diversity to police recruits in Ontario.
And now that I reflect back, there's definitely forms of PTSD that's there, because I never wanted to go out the day after or the week after sometimes. And it doesn't matter how many checks you get, you don't get immune to it.
Recent studies have found that street checks, carding, and other forms of proactive policing, as they're known, can have serious detrimental effects on the psychological well-being of those stopped. Criminologist Akwasi Owusu-Bempa.
You know, deaths at the hands of the police, whether justified or not, these constitute just a very small proportion of police interactions with members of the public. They're many times more interactions where force is not used, but where there may still be serious damage done to the individuals.
And beyond traumatizing those stopped, these random checks do little to improve public safety. A U.S. 2019 study published by the National Academy of Sciences suggests the opposite can be true. Black and Latino adolescents report they engaged in more criminal behavior months after being stopped by the police.
So not only can we question whether or not carding as it was practiced was an effective crime-fighting tool, but we need to raise the prospects that it was actually counterproductive, that by stopping and questioning people, and many people felt that they were being harassed, it makes it more difficult for the police to gather information. And we're actually seeing increasingly that negative encounters can actually be criminogenic.
Mike Huff is an emeritus professor at Birkbeck University of London. He says police often do not invest the time required to build a rapport with the community.
At the end of the day, policing by consent is cheaper and more stable than trying to hold populations in a firm deterrent grip. So one should invest for the future. This is easy for academics to say, of course, but if we're to get out of the sorts of toxic spirals of relationships between police and minority groups, that investment's needed.
The next station is Brixton, where this train terminates. All change, please. Change.
I'm arriving in Brixton, South London, to meet up with Mohamed Hashi. He's a city councillor, Black community leader, and member of citizens groups that monitor police stops. Hashi, who has no police record, says he's been stopped and searched at least 60 times since the age of 13, generally on the assumption by police that he's dealing drugs. He has also been caught up in the street violence in his district. A little more than a decade ago, when he was 23, while trying to break up a fight, he was shot in the shoulder, severing a nerve in his left arm.
In this area where we've got young people being stabbed and shot, just a few days ago we had a double shooting on Five Ways in Brixton. Just yesterday we had a shooting in Brixton Hill. So nobody here is saying, get rid of stop and search or we don't like, but we know you're not actually doing the stop and search for the benefit of the community. You're doing it for the benefit of your statistics and how it looks externally, because it looks like you're doing some work. What you should be doing is looking in these areas and saying, how many youth organizations in that area are being funded? How many of them are doing work with the young people in the area?
In the early 1800s, Robert Peel's 9 principles for law enforcement were established, principles still invoked by police forces around the world. One of Peel's principles was to, quote, prevent crime and disorder as an alternative to the repression of disorder by military force. What do you think Robert Peel would say if he were to be strolling through Brixton today, or any other part of London for that matter?
I think he'd say, where are the police? Because I don't think he'd recognize them. Because they're not of the community. They're not, you know, they don't understand or empathize with the people within these communities. And this is me generalizing in terms of some of the officers that are not, because we do have some good officers, but they are overshadowed constantly by the actions of those bad officers. You know, we don't even know if it's 50-50, because when officers do something reckless or something crazy, that's it. You don't see the goodness in the police, because you feel like they're representatives. And I feel like until the police hold each other to account, you know, and feel that passion, because even you speaking about Robert Peel now, you could hear the passion he had for it, you know. You can hear the passion he had for communities and the protection of these communities. And the truth is, right now, our communities do not feel protected by the police. We feel under siege from the police. And the police are supposed to be part of our community. You know, they're supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to be like, all right there, Harry, how you doing today? You know, you're supposed to have those kind of relationships. You're supposed to have a relationship where you can say to the police officer, can you come around to my house and talk to my son? You know, he was really bad at school. Can you just, you know, give him a talk to? You don't have that. You know, when the police come, they're kicking off your door, or raiding your house, or stopping you because they think you're a drug. They think the worst of you. Because a lot of the time we're made to feel like the police think the worst of our communities as a whole, which is, again, what I don't think Robert Peel would be happy to see.
Many see police today as the occupying forces they were meant to replace. Some are now calling for the complete defunding of the police. Alex Baitali.
We can't get to a world without police while we have in place profound systems of exploitation, because that's what policing exists to manage. So when we think about trying to get to a world without police, we have to be thinking about fundamental questions of economic and political justice.
In part 2 of this series, we'll examine the provocative question, do we even need the police? We'll also look at the current pressures police are under, competing cultures within policing, and whether police legitimacy is still robust enough to render reform possible.
You're listening to The Evolution of Policing, the first of a 2-part series on the role of police in our society. It's presented by Ideas contributor Kyle G. Brown and produced by Mary Link. To read more about this series or to get our podcasts or audio online, go to cbc.ca/ideas. Ideas can also be found on Facebook and on Twitter. Technical production, Pat Martin and Danielle Duval. Web producer, Lisa Ayuso. Senior producer, Nicola Lukšić. Greg Kelly is the executive producer of Ideas, and I'm Nala Ayed.